question, which maybe it was. Then he said, "Well, I don't suppose I ever thought about it." Then, "No, I don't suppose I ever thought about it." "Don't you have a good time?" I asked. "And you a big shot? Don't you have a good time being a big shot?" I didn't let go. I knew it was a question you haven't got any right to ask anybody, not with the tone of voice I heard coming out of my mouth, but I couldn't let go. You grow up with somebody, and he's a success, a big shot, and you're a failure, but he treats you just the way he always did and hasn't changed a bit. But that's what drives you to it, no matter what names you call yourself while you try to stick the knife in. There's a kind of snobbery of failure. It's a club. It's the old school. It's skull and bones. And there's no nasty, supercilious twist to a mouth like the twist the drunk gets when he hangs over the bar beside the old pal who has turned out to be a big shot and who hasn't changed a bit, or when the old pal takes him home to dinner and introduces him to the pretty little clear-eyed woman and the healthy kids. There wasn't any pretty little woman in Adam's shabby apartment, but he was a big shot, and I let him have it. But it didn't register on him. He simply turned on me the candid blue gaze, slightly shaded by thought now, and said, "It just isn't something I ever thought about." Then the smile did the trick to the mouth, which under ordinary circumstances looked like a nice, clean, decisive surgical wound, well healed and no pucker. So I tried to make what amends I could for being what I was, and pulled out the soft and sweet stop, and said, "Yeah, we did have a good time when we were kids, you and Anne and me." Yes, Adam Stanton, Anne Stanton, and Jack Burden, back in Burden's Landing, had a good time when they were children by the sea. A squall might, and did, pile in off the gulf, and the sky blacked out with the rain, and the palm trees heaved in distraction, and then leaned steady with the veins gleaming like wet tin in the last turgid, bilious, tattered light. But it didn't chill us or kill us in the kingdom by the sea, for we were safe inside a white house, their house or my house, and stood by the window to watch the surf pile up beyond the seawall like whipped cream. And back in the room behind us would be Governor Stanton, or Mr. Ellis Burden, or both, for they were friends, or Judge Irwin, for he was a friend too, and there wasn't a wind that would ever have the nerve to bother Governor Stanton or Mr. Ellis Burden or Judge Irwin. "You and Anne and me," Adam Stanton had said to me, and I had said it to him. So one morning, after I had managed to get out of bed, I called Anne up and said, "I hadn't thought about you in a long time, but the other night I saw Adam, and he said you and he and I used to have a good time when we were kids. So how about having dinner with me, even if we are on crutches now?" She said she would. She certainly wasn't on crutches, but we didn't have any fun. She asked me what I was doing, and I told her, not a blessed thing, just waiting for my cash to run out. She didn't tell me I ought to do something, and didn't even look it, which was something. So I asked her what she was doing, and she laughed and said, "Not a blessed thing," which I knew was a lie, for she was always fooling around with orphans and halfwits and blind niggers, and not even getting paid for it. And looking at her, you could know it was all a waste of something, and the something wasn't money. So I said, "Well, I hope you're doing it in pleasant company." "Not particularly," she said. I looked at her close and saw what I knew I would see and what I had seen a good many times when she wasn't sitting across from me. I saw Anne Stanton, who was not exactly a beauty, maybe, but who was Anne Stanton. Anne Stanton, the brown-toned, golden-lighted face, not as dark as Adam's, with a hint of the positive structure beneath the skin, which was drawn over the bone with something, a suggestion of the tension which was in Adam's face, as though the fabricator of the job hadn't wanted to waste any material in softnesses and slacknesses, and had stylized the product pretty cleanly. The dark hair drawn smoothly, almost tautly, away from the accurate part. The blue eyes which looked at you like Adam's eyes, with the same directness, but in which the clear, abstract ice blue was replaced by a deeper, coiling, troubled blue. Sometimes, anyway. They looked alike, Adam and Anne. They might have been twins. They even had the same smile. But the mouth it came on was, in Anne's case, different. It didn't carry any suggestion of the nice, clean, decisive, well-healed surgical wound. The fabricator had, on this item, allowed himself the luxury of a little extra material. Not too much, but enough. That was Ann Stanton, and I saw what I knew I would see. She sat there before me, very erect, with her head held high and straight on the fine, round stalk of her neck above the small, squarish shoulders, and with her rather small but roundly modeled bare arms laid close to her sides in mathematical accuracy. And looking at her, I thought how, below the level of the table, her small legs would be laid accurately together, thigh to thigh, knee to knee, ankle to ankle. There was, in fact, always something a little stylized about her, something of the effect one observes in certain Egyptian bas-reliefs and statuettes of princesses of a late period, forms in which grace and softness, without being the less grace or softness, are caught in mathematical formality. Ann Stanton always looked level at you, and you had the feeling that she was looking at something far away. She always held her head high, and you had the feeling that she was waiting for a voice which you wouldn't be able to hear. She always stood so trim and erect, and you had the feeling that all her grace and softness was caught in the rigor of an idea which you could not define. I said, "You planning on being an old maid?" She laughed and said, "I'm not planning on anything. I quit making plans a long time back." We danced in the handkerchief-big space between the speakeasy tables, on which stood the plates of half-eaten spaghetti or chicken bones and the bottles of Dago Red. For about 5 minutes, the dancing had some value in itself. Then it became very much like acting out some complicated and portentous business in a dream, which seems to have a meaning, but whose meaning you can't figure out. Then the music was over, and stopping dancing was like waking up from the dream, being glad to wake up and escape, and yet distressed, because now you won't ever know what it had been all about. She must have felt the same way about it, for when, later, I asked her to dance again, she said that she didn't feel like it, she'd rather talk. We talked, quite a lot, but it was a little bit like the dancing. You can't keep on talking forever about what a hell of a good time you had when you were kids. I took her to her apartment building, which was quite a few cuts above Adam's joint, for Governor Stanton hadn't died exactly a pauper, and left her in the lobby. She said good night and, "Be a good boy, Jack." "Will you have dinner with me again?" I asked her. "Any time you want," she said. "Any time in the world, you know that." Yes, I knew it. And she did have dinner with me again several times. The last time she said, "I've seen your father." "Yeah," I said in an unencouraging way. "Don't be like that," she said. "Like what?" "Oh, you know what I mean," she said. "Don't you even want to know how he is?" "I know how he is," I said. "He's sitting in that hole he lives in down there, or he's helping around that mission with his bums, or writing those damn fool little leaflets they pass out to you on the street, all about Mark 4:6 or Job 7:5, and his specs are down on the end of his nose, and the dandruff is like a snowstorm in the Dakotas down on his black coat collar." She didn't say anything for a minute, then said, "I saw him on the street, and he didn't look well. He looked sick. I didn't recognize him at first." "Trying to pass you some of that junk?" I asked. "Yes," she said. "He held out a piece of paper to me, and I was in a hurry, so I just automatically put out my hand for it. Then I realized he was staring right in my face. I didn't recognize him at first." She paused a little. "That was about 2 weeks back." "I haven't seen him in nearly a year," I said. "Oh, Jack," she said. "You oughtn't do that. You ought to see him." "Look here, what can I say to him? And God knows he hasn't got anything to tell me. Nobody made him live like that. Nobody made him walk out of his law office either and not even bother to shut the door behind him." "But, Jack," she said, he's doing what he wants to do. And besides, if he was fool enough to do what he did just because he couldn't get along with a woman, especially a woman like my mother, if he couldn't give her what she wanted, whatever the hell it was she wanted, and he couldn't give her, then..." "Don't talk like that," she said sharply. "Look here, I said. Just because your old man was governor once and died in a mahogany tester bed with a couple of high-priced doctors leaning over him and adding up the bill in their heads, and because you think he was Jesus Christ in a black string tie, you needn't try to talk to me like an old woman. I'm not talking about your family, I'm talking about mine. And I can't help seeing the plain, unvarnished truth, and if you... Well, you don't have to talk to me about it, she said, or anybody. It's the truth. Oh, the truth, she exclaimed, and clenched her right hand on the tablecloth. How do you know it's the truth? You don't know anything about it. You don't know what made them do what they did. I know the truth. I know what my mother is like, and you do too. And I know my father was a fool to let her get him down. Don't be so bitter, she said, and reached out to seize my forearm and set her sharp fingers in it through the coat and shake it a little. I'm not bitter. I don't give a damn what they did, or do, or why. Oh, Jack, she said, still clutching my forearm, but not hard now. Can't you love them a little, or forgive them, or just not think about them, or something? Something different from the way you are? I could go for the rest of my life and not think about them, I said. Then I noticed that she was shaking her head ever so little from side to side, and that her eyes were as dark a blue as they ever got and too bright, and that she had drawn in the edge of her lower lip and had set her teeth to it. I reached my right hand over and took her hand off my left forearm and laid it down flat, palm down on the tablecloth, and covered it with my hand. I'm sorry, I said. You're not, Jack, she said. You're not sorry. Not really. You aren't ever sorry about anything. Or glad, either. You're just... Oh, I don't know what. I am sorry, I said. Oh, you just think you're sorry. Or glad. You aren't, really. If you think you're sorry, who in the hell can tell you that you aren't? I demanded, for I was a brass-bound idealist then, as I have stated, and was not going to call for a plebiscite on whether I was sorry or not. That sounds all right, she said, but it isn't. I don't know why. Oh, yes, I do. If you've never been sorry or glad, then you haven't got any way to know the next time whether you are or not. All right, I said, but can I tell you this? Something is happening inside me which I choose to call sorry. You can say it, but you don't know. Then snatching her hand from under my hand. Oh, you start to feel sorry or glad or something, but it just doesn't come to anything. You mean like a little green apple that's got a worm in it and falls off the tree before it ever gets ripe? She laughed and answered, Yes, like little green apples with worms in them. Well, I said, here's a little green apple with a worm in it. I'm sorry. I was sorry. Or what went for sorry in my lexicon. I was sorry that I had ruined the evening, but candor compelled me to admit that there hadn't been much of an evening to ruin. I didn't ask her to go to dinner with me again, at least not that time while I was out of a job and doing the sleeping. I had hunted up Adam and heard him play the piano, and I had sat across the spaghetti and the Dago Red and looked at Ann Stanton. And as a result of what Ann said to me, I had gone down to the slums and seen the old man, the not very tall man who had once been stocky but whose face now drooped in puffy gray folds beneath the gray hair, with the steel-rimmed spectacles hanging on the end of the nose, and whose shoulders, thin now and snowed with dandruff, sagged down as with the pull of the apparently disjunctive, careful belly which made the vest of his black suit pop up above the belt and the slack-hanging pants. And in every case I had found what I had known I was going to find, because they had happened and nothing was going to change what had happened. I had been sinking down in the sleep like a drowning man in water, and they had flashed across my eyes again the way people say the past flashes across the eyes of the drowning man. Well, I could go back to sleep now, till my cash ran out anyway. I could be Rip Van Winkle. Only I thought that the Rip Van Winkle story was all wrong. You went to sleep for a long time, and when you woke up, nothing whatsoever had changed. No matter how long you slept, it was the same. But I didn't get to do much sleeping. I got a job. Or rather, the job got me. The telephone got me out of bed one morning. It was Sadie Burke who said, Get down here to the Capitol at 10 o'clock. The boss wants to see you.
The who?
I said. The boss, she said. Willie Stock, Governor Stock, or don't you read the papers?
No, but somebody told me in the barber shop.
It's true, she said. And the boss said for you to get down here at 10.
And she hung up the phone.
Well, I said to myself, maybe things do change while you sleep. But I didn't believe it then, and didn't really believe it when I went into the big room with the black oak paneling and padded across the long red carpet under the eyes of all the genuine oil paintings of all the bewhiskered old men toward the man who wasn't very old and wasn't bewhiskered and who sat behind a desk in front of the high windows and who got up as I approached. Hell, I thought. It's just Willie. It was just Willie, even though he was wearing something different from the country blue serge he'd had on back at Upton. But he just had the thing flung on him anyhow, with his tie loose and to one side and the collar unbuttoned, and his hair hung down over his forehead the way it used to. I thought for a second that maybe the meaty lips were laid together firmer than they used to be, but before I could be sure, he was grinning and had come around to the front of the desk. So I thought again it was just Willie. He put out his hand and said, "Hello, Jack." "Congratulations," I said. "I hear they fired you." "You heard wrong," I said. "I quit." "You were smart," he said, "because when I get through with that outfit, they wouldn't be able to pay you. They won't be able to pay the nigger washes of spittoons." "That'll suit me," I allowed. "Want a job?" he asked. "I'd consider a proposition." $300 a month, he said, and traveling expenses, when you travel. Who do I work for, the state? Hell no, me. Looks like you'd be working for me, I said. This governorship doesn't pay but $5,000. All right, he said and laughed. I'll be working for you then. Then I recollected how he'd done right well in his law practice. I'll give it a try, I said. Fine, he said. Then, Lucy's wanting to see you. Come to dinner tomorrow night at the house.
You mean the mansion?
What the hell you think I mean? A tourist home? A boarding house? Sure, the mansion. Yes, the mansion. He was going to treat me just like old times and take me home to dinner and introduce me to the pretty little woman and the healthy kid. Boy, he was saying, we sure do rattle around in that place, Lucy and Tom and me. What am I supposed to do? I asked him. Eat, he said. Come at 6:30 and eat hearty. Call up Lucy and tell her what you want to eat.
I mean, what do I do for the job?
Hell, I don't know, he said. Something'll turn up. He was right about that.
Chapter 3. It was always the same way when I came home and saw my mother. I would be surprised that it was the way it was, but I knew at the same time that I had known it would be this way. I would come home with the firm conviction that she didn't really care a thing about me, that I was just another man whom she wanted to have around because she was the kind of woman who had to have men around and had to make them dance to her tune. But as soon as I saw her, I would forget all that. Sometimes I forgot it even before I saw her. Anyway, when I forgot it, I would wonder why we couldn't get along. I would wonder, even though I knew what would happen, even though I would always know that the scene into which I was about to step and in which I was about to say the words I would say had happened before or had never stopped happening, and that I would always just be entering the wide, white, high-ceilinged hall to see across the distance of the floor, which gleamed like dark ice, my mother, who stood in a doorway, beyond her the flicker of firelight in the shadowy room, and smiled at me with a sudden and innocent happiness like a girl. Then she would come toward me, with a brittle, excited clatter of heels and a quick, throaty laugh, and stop before me and seize a little bunch of my coat between the thumb and forefinger of each hand, in a way that was childlike and both weak and demanding, and lift her face up to me, turning it somewhat to one side so that I could put the expected kiss upon her cheek. The texture of her cheek would be firm and smooth, quite cool, and I would breathe the scent which she always used, and as I kissed her, I would see the plucked accuracy of the eyebrow, the delicate lines at the corner of the eye toward me, and note the crinkled, shadowed texture of the eyelid, which would flicker sharply over the blue eye. The eye, very slightly protruding, would be fixed glitteringly on some point beyond me. That was the way it had always been. When I had come home from school, when I had come back from camps, when I had come back from college, when I had come back from jobs. And that was the way it was that late rainy afternoon, on the borderline between winter and spring, back in 1933, when I came back home again, after not coming home for a long time. It had been 6 or 8 months since my last visit. That time we had had a row about my working for Governor Stark. We always sooner or later got into a row about something, and in the 2.5 years that I had been working for Willie, it usually in the end came round to Willie. And if his name wasn't even mentioned, he stood there like a shadow behind us. Not that it mattered much what we rowed about. There was a shadow taller and darker than the shadow of Willie standing behind us. But I always came back, and I had come back this time. I would find myself drawn back. It was that way, and as always, it seemed to be a fresh start, a wiping out of all the things which I knew could not be wiped out.
"Leave the bags in your car," she said. "The boy'll get them."
And she drew me toward the open door of the living room, where the firelight was, and down the length of the room to the long couch. I saw the bowl of ice, the siphon of soda, the scotch on the glass-top table, all the items sparkling in the firelight.
"Sit down," she said. "Sit down, son."
And put the fingers of her right hand against my chest to give a little shove. It wasn't much of a shove. It didn't put me off my balance. But I sat down and sank back into the couch. I watched her mix me a drink, and then a sort of excuse of a drink for herself, for she never took much. She held the glass out to me and laughed that quick throaty laugh again.
"Take it," she said,
and her face seemed to proclaim that she was offering me something which was absolutely special, something which was so precious that it couldn't be tied on God's green globe. There's a lot of liquor in the world, even scotch, but I took it and gave a pull, feeling too that it was something special. She sank down on the couch with an easy motion, vaguely suggestive of a flutter and preening as when a bird touches a bough, and took a sip, and lifted her head as if to let the liquor trickle into her throat. She had drawn one leg up beneath her, and the other hung over with the sharp tip of the gray suede pump stretched forward to just touch the floor with the precision of a dancer. She turned cleanly from the erect waist to look straight at me, twisting the gray cloth of the dress. The firelight defined her small, poised features, one side bright, one side in shadow, and emphasized the slight, famished, haunting hollow beneath the cheekbones. I always figured, after I got old enough to do any kind of figuring, that it was that, the hollow beneath the cheekbone, that got them. And the careful, swooping lift of her piled-up hair. Her hair was yellowish, like metal, with gray in it now, but the gray was metallic, too, like spun metal woven and coiled into the yellow. It looked as though that was the way it had been intended from the very first to be. And a damned expensive job. Every detail. I looked at her and thought, well, she's pushing 55, but I'll hand it to her. And suddenly I felt old, and the 35 years I had been living suddenly seemed to stretch back forever. But I had to hand it to her. She kept on looking at me, not saying anything, with that look which always said, "You've got something I want, something I need, something I've got to have." And said, too, "I've got something for you. I won't tell you what, not yet, but I've got something for you, too." The hollow in the cheeks, the hungry business. The glittering eyes, the promising business. And both at the same time. It was quite a trick. I took the last of the drink and held the glass in my hand. She reached out and took it, still watching me, and reached out to set it on the little table. Then she said, "Oh, son, you look tired." "I'm not," I said, and felt the stubbornness in me.
"You are," she said,
and took me by the sleeve of the forearm and drew me toward her. I didn't come at first. I just let her pull the arm. She didn't pull hard, but she kept on looking straight at me. I let myself go and keeled over toward her. I lay on my back, with my head on her lap, the way I had known I would do. She let her left hand lie on my chest, the thumb and forefinger holding and revolving back and forth, a button on my shirt, and her right hand on my forehead. Then she put it over my eyes and moved it slowly upward over my forehead. Her hands were always cool. It was one of the first things I remembered ever knowing. For a long time, she didn't talk any. She just moved the hand over my eyes and forehead. I had known how it would be, and knew how it had been before and how it would be after. But she had the trick of making a little island right in the middle of time and of your knowing, which is what time does to you. Then she said, "You're tired, son." Well, I wasn't tired, but I wasn't not tired either, and tiredness didn't have anything to do with the way things were. Then after a while, "Are you working hard, son?" I said, "So-so, I reckon." Then after another while, that man you work for, what about it?" I said. The hand stopped on my forehead, and I knew it was my voice that stopped it. "Nothing," she said. "Only you don't have to work for that man. Theodore could get you a..." "I don't want any job Theodore would get for me," I said, and tried to heave myself up. But have you ever tried to heave yourself up when you're flat on your back on a deep couch and somebody has a hand on your forehead? She held her hand firm on my forehead and leaned over and said, "Don't now, don't. Theodore is my husband. He's your stepfather. Don't talk that way. He'd like to..." "Look here," I said. "I told you I..." But she said, "Hush, son, hush," and put her hand over my eyes and began to move it again upward over my forehead. She didn't say anything else, but she had already said what she had said, and she had to start the island trick all over again. Perhaps she had said it just so she could start over again, just to prove that she could do it. Anyway, she did it all over again, and it worked. Until the front door banged, and there were steps in the hall. I knew that it was Theodore Morell and started to heave up again. But even now, just for the last instant, she pressed her palm down on my forehead and didn't let go until the sound of Theodore's steps had entered the room. I got to my feet, feeling my coat crawling up around my neck and my tie under one ear, and looked across at Theodore, who had a beautiful blonde mustache and apple cheeks and pale hair laid like taffy on a round skull, and a hint of dignity at the belly. "Bend over, you bastard. Bend over 100 times every morning and touch the floor, you bastard, or Mrs. Morell won't like you, and then where would you be?" And a slightly adenoidal lisp, like too much hot porridge, when he opened the aperture under the beautiful blonde mustache. My mother approached him with that bright stride and her shoulders well back, and stopped right before the young executive. The young executive put his right arm about her shoulder and kissed her with the aperture under the beautiful blonde mustache, and she seized him by the sleeve and drew him over toward me, and he said, "Well, well, old boy, it's fine to see you. How's tricks? How's the old politician?" "Fine," I said, "but I'm not a politician. I'm a hired hand." "Ho-ho," he said, "don't try to kid me. They say you and the governor are just like this." And he held up two not-thin, very clean, perfectly manicured fingers for me to admire. "You don't know the governor," I replied, "for the only thing the governor is just like this with," and I held up two not very clean and quite imperfectly manicured fingers, "is the governor, and now and then God Almighty when he needs somebody to hold the hog while he cuts the throat." "Well, the way he's going," Theodore began. "Sit down, y'all," my mother told us, and we sat down and took the glasses she handed us. She turned on a light. I leaned back in my chair and said yes and said no and looked down the long room, which I knew better than any room in the world and which I always came back to, no matter what I said. I noticed that there was a new piece in it, a tall Sheraton breakfront desk in the place where the kidney desk had been. Well, the kidney desk would be in the attic now in the second string museum, while we sat in the first string museum, and while Bowman and Heatherford Limited, London, wrote a large figure in the black column of the Ledger. There was always a change in the room. When I came home, I'd always look around and wonder what it would be, for there had been a long procession of choice examples through that room. Spinets, desks, tables, chairs, each more choice than the last, each in turn finding its way to the attic to make way for a new perfection. Well, the room had come a long way from the way I first remembered it, moving toward some ideal perfection which was in my mother's head, or in the head of a dealer in New Orleans or New York or London, and maybe, just before she died, the room would achieve its ideal perfection, and she would sit in it, a trim old lady with piled-up white hair and silky skin sagging off a fine jawbone and blue eyes blinking rapidly, and would take a cup of tea to celebrate the ideal. The furniture changed, but the people in it changed too. Way back, there had been the thick-set, strong man, not tall, with a shock of tangled black hair on his head and steel-rimmed glasses on his nose, and a habit of buttoning his vest up wrong, and a big gold watch chain, which I liked to pull at. Then he wasn't there, and my mother pressed my head against her breast and said, "Your daddy isn't coming back any more, son." "Is he dead?" I asked. "Will he have a funeral?" "No," she said. "He isn't dead. He's gone away, but you can think of him like he was dead, son."
"Why did he go away?"
"Because he didn't love mother. That's why he went away."
"I love you, mother," I said. "I'll love you always."
"Yes, son, yes, you love your mother," she said, and held me tight against her breast. So the scholarly attorney was gone. I was about 6 years old then. Then there was the tycoon, who was gaunt and bald and wheezed on the stair. "Why does Daddy Ross puff going upstairs?" I said.
"Hush," my mother said. "Hush, son."
"Why, mother?"
"Because Daddy Ross isn't well, son."
Then the tycoon was dead. He had not lasted long. So my mother put me in a school in Connecticut and left me to go across the ocean. When she came back, there was another man, who was tall and slender and wore white suits and smoked long, thin cigars and had a thin black mustache. He was the Count, and my mother was a Countess. The Count sat in the room with people and smiled a great deal and didn't say much. People looked sideways at him, but he looked straight at them and smiled to show the whitest teeth in the world under the thin, accurate black mustache. When nobody was there, he played the piano all day, and then went out wearing black boots and tight white trousers and rode a horse and made it jump over gates and gallop along the beach till its sides were flecked with lather and were pumping fit to die. Then the Count came into the house and drank whiskey and held a Persian cat on his knee and stroked it with a hand which was not big, but which was so strong that he could make men frown when he shook hands with them. And once I saw four blue-black parallel marks on my mother's upper right arm. "Mother," I said, "look, what happened?"
"Nothing," she said. "I just hurt myself."
And she pulled the scarf down over her arm. The Count's name was Covelli. People said, "That Count fellow is a son of a bitch, but he can evermore ride a horse." Then he was gone. I was sorry, for I had liked the Count. I had liked to watch him ride a horse. Then there was quite a while when there was nobody. Then there was the young executive, who had been a young executive from the day his mother gave the last push, and would be a young executive until the day they drained out the blood and pumped in the embalming fluid. But that would be a long time off, because he was just 44, and sitting at the desk at the oil company, where he earned the pin money to supplement his allowance, wasn't breaking him down fast. Well, I'd sat in that room with all of them, the scholarly attorney and the tycoon and the Count and the young executive, and had watched the furniture change. So now I sat and looked at Theodore and at the new Sheraton break front desk and wondered how permanent they were. I had come home. I was the thing that always came back. It kept on raining that night. I lay in a big, fine old family bed, which had come from somebody else's family. A long time ago there had been a white iron bed in my room, standing on the floor matting, and the big, fine old mahogany Burden family bed, which hadn't been fine enough and which was now in the attic, had been in my mother's room, and listened to the rain hiss on the live oak and magnolia leaves. In the morning it had stopped raining, and there was sun. I went out and saw the thin pools of water standing on the black ground like sheets of isinglass. Around the japonicas, the white and red and coral petals, which had been shattered from the blossoms, floated on the blackly gleaming pools. Some of them floated with the curled edges upward like boats, and around them other petals floated upside down or had shipped water, making a gay carnage as though a battleship had fired a couple of salvos into a fleet of carnival barges and gondolas in some giddy, happy, far-off land. There was a massive japonica tree by the steps. I leaned over to scoop up some petals in my hand. The water was very cold. I held the petals in my hand and walked down the curving drive to the gate. I stood there, pressing the petals in the palm and looking out at the bay, which was very bright beyond the strip of whitish sand streaked with drift. But before noon it began to rain again, a long drizzle and drip from the spongy sky that lasted 2 days. That afternoon and the next morning and the next afternoon I put on a raincoat belonging to the young executive and walked in the drizzle. Not that I was a walker who just has to have his lungs flushed out with ozone, but walking seemed the thing to do. The first afternoon I walked down the beach, past the Stanton place, which was cold and hollow-looking beyond the dripping leaves, and on out to the Irwin place, where Judge Irwin put me in a chair with my heels to the fire and opened a bottle of his choice old Maryland rye to give me a drink and invited me to dinner the next night. But I took one drink and left, and walked on where there weren't any more houses, just brush and oak tangles with here and there a pine rising, and occasionally an open patch of ground with a gray shack. And the next day I walked up the bay, through the streets of the town and on beyond, till I came to the little half-moon-shaped cove off the bay, where the pine grove came down close to the white sand. I walked just under the shelter of the pines, my heels deep in the needles. Then I came out on the sand. There was a place where a half-charred log lay, very black with the wetness, and around it the sodden ashes and the black butts of driftwood, blacker for the white sand. People still came here for picnics. Well, I had come here for picnics, too. I knew what picnics were like. I knew what a picnic was like, all right. Anne and Adam and I had come here years before when we were kids, but it was not raining that day, not till the end. It was very hot and very still. You could look down the bay beyond the cove toward the gulf and see the water lifting up into the light as though the horizon had ceased to exist. We swam and ate our lunch, lying on the sand, then fished some more. But we didn't have any luck. By that time clouds had begun to pile, working in over the whole sky except toward the west beyond the pines where the light struck through the break. The water was very still and suddenly dark with the darkness of the sky, and away across the bay the line of woods looked black now, not green, above the whiteness of the line which was the beach way over there. A boat, a catboat, was becalmed over in that direction, nearly a mile away, and under the sky and over the dark water and against the black line of the woods, you never saw anything so heartbreakingly white as the sharp sail. "We better get in," Adam said. "It's going to blow." "Not quick," Anne said. "Let's swim again." "Better not." Adam hesitated and looked off at the sky. "Let's," she insisted and pulled at his arm. He didn't respond, still scanning the sky. All at once she dropped his arm and laughed and began to run toward the water. She didn't run directly to the water, but up the beach, toward a little spit with her bobbed hair back loose on the air. I watched her run. She ran with her arms not quite outspread, crooked at the elbows and with a motion of her legs which was graceful and free, and somehow awkward at the same time, as though she hadn't quite forgotten one kind of running, the child's running, and hadn't quite learned another kind of running, the woman's running. The legs seemed to be hung too loose, somewhat uncertainly, from the little hips, which weren't quite rounded yet. I watched her and noticed that her legs were long, which I had never noticed before. It wasn't a noise, but instead a stillness that made me turn suddenly to Adam. He was staring at me. When I met his eyes, his face flushed, and he jerked his eyes off me as though embarrassed. Then he said, "I'll race you," huskily, and ran after her. I ran too, and his feet threw the sand back at me. Anne was out in the water, swimming now. Adam plunged in after her and swam hard and straight, outdistancing me. He passed right by Anne and kept on swimming. He was a powerful swimmer. He hadn't wanted to swim, but now he would swim straight out, hard and fast. I came up to Anne and slowed down and said, "Hello." She lifted her head high for an instant, with the gracile motion a seal has, and smiled, then curled over forward in a clean surface dive. Her sharp small heels, side by side, flickered for a second above the water, then drew under. I caught up with her, and she did it again. Every time I caught up with her, she would lift her head and smile and dive again. The fifth time I caught up, she didn't dive. She rolled over with a light, lounging twist of her body and floated on her back, looking up at the sky, her arms spread wide. So I turned over, too, and floated, about 5 or 6 feet from her, and looked up at the sky. The sky was darker now, with a purplish-greenish cast, the color of a turning grape. But it still looked high, with worlds of air under it. A gull crossed, very high, directly above me. Against the sky it was whiter even than the sail had been. It passed clear across all the sky I could see. I wondered if Anne had seen the gull. When I looked at her, her eyes were closed. Her arms were still spread out wide, and her hair wavered out free on the water from around her head. Her head was far back, her chin lifted. Her face looked very smooth, as though she were asleep. As I lay in the water, I could see her profile sharp against the far-off black trees. All at once she turned in the direction away from me, as though I hadn't been there, and began to swim in. She swam with a slow stroke now that seemed retarded and yet effortless. Her thin arms rose and sank with a languid and bemused and fastidious punctuality, like your own effortless motion in a dream. Before we got to the beach, the rain had begun, big, spaced, heavy, independent drops that prickled the yet glossy surface of the water. Then it was a driving gust of rain, and the surface of the water was gone. We rose out of the water and stood on the sand with the rain whipping our skin and looked out at Adam, who was coming in. He still had a long way to come. Down the bay beyond him, to the south, the lightning kept forking out of the dark sky with steady thunder. Now and then Adam seemed, for a moment, to be lost in a driving sheet of rain which would rake over the water. Watching him, Anne stood there with her head bowed forward a little, almost pensively, and her shoulders hunched and her arms crossed over her insignificant breasts, hugging herself as though she were just about to shiver and her knees tight together and slightly bent. Adam came in, we gathered up our stuff, put on our sopping sandals, and passed through the pine grove, where the black masses heaved above us and the boughs made a strider which you caught now and then coming out of the roar. We reached our car and went home. That summer I was 17, Adam was about my age, and Anne was 4 years younger, or about that. That was way back before the World War, or rather, before we got into it. That was a picnic I never forgot. I suppose that that day I first saw Anne and Adam as separate, individual people, whose ways of acting were special, mysterious, and important. And perhaps, too, that day I first saw myself as a person. But that's not what I'm talking about. What happened was this. I got an image in my head that never got out. We see a great many things and can remember a great many things, but that is different. We get very few of the true images in our heads of the kind I'm talking about, the kind which become more and more vivid for us, as if the passage of the years did not obscure their reality, but, year by year, drew off another veil to expose a meaning which we had only dimly surmised at first. Very probably the last veil will not be removed, for there are not enough years, but the brightness of the image increases, and our conviction increases that the brightness is meaning, or the legend of meaning, and without the image our lives would be nothing except an old piece of film rolled on a spool and thrown into a desk drawer among the unanswered letters. The image I got in my head that day was the image of her face lying in the water, very smooth, with the eyes closed, under the dark greenish-purple sky, with the white gull passing over. This is not to say that I fell in love with Anne that day. She was a kid then. That came later. But the image would have been there if I had never fallen in love with her, or had never seen her again, or had grown to detest her. There were times afterwards when I was not in love with Anne. Anne told me she wouldn't marry me, and after a while I married Lois, who was a better-looking girl than Anne, the kind they turn around on the street to see, and I was in love with Lois. But the image was there all the time, growing brighter as the veils were withdrawn, and making the promise of a greater brightness. So when I stepped out of the pine grove that drizzly early spring afternoon a long time afterward, and saw the charred log on the white sand where a picnic had been, I remembered that picnic back in the summer of 1915, the last picnic we had before I left home to go to college. I wasn't going such a hell of a long way to college, just up to the state university.
"Oh, son," my mother said, "why don't you be sensible and go to Harvard or Princeton?"
For a woman out of the scrub country of Arkansas, my mother had certainly learned a lot by that time about our better educational institutions.
"Or even Williams," she said. "They say it's a nice, refined place."
"I went to school where you wanted," I said, "and it was sure refined."
"Or even Virginia," she went on,
looking brightly at my face and not hearing a word I said.
"Your father went to the University of Virginia."
"That shouldn't be such a big recommendation to you," I said, and thought how smart I was to get that one off. I'd got in the habit in arguments with her of making some reference to his leaving. But she didn't hear that either. She just went on,
"If you were east, then it would be easier for you to come over for the summer and see me."
"They're fighting a war over there now," I said.
"They'll stop before long," she said. "Then it'll be easier."
"Yeah, and it would be easier for you to tell somebody I was in Harvard than in a place they never heard of like State. They wouldn't even have heard of the name of the state it was in."
"It's just I want you to go to a nice place, son, where you'll make nice friends. And like I said, it would be easier for you to come over to see me in the summer."
She was talking about going to Europe again, and was very annoyed at the war. The Count had been gone quite a spell, since just before the war, and she was going back across. She did go back across after the war, but she didn't get any more counts. Maybe she figured it was too expensive to marry them. She didn't marry again until the young executive. Well, I told her I didn't want to go to a nice place and didn't want any nice friends and wasn't going to Europe and wasn't going to take any money from her. That last part about the money just slipped out in the heat of the moment. It seemed a big, manly thing to say, but the effect was so much superior to anything I had expected that I couldn't renege and spoil the drama. It knocked her breath out. It almost floored her. I suppose that she wasn't accustomed to hear anything in pants talk like that. Not that she didn't try to persuade me, but I got on my high horse and was stubborn. 1,000 times in the next 4 years I thought what a damn fool I was. I'd be hashing or typing or even in the last year doing part-time newspaper work and would think how I had thrown away about $5,000 just because I'd read something in a book about its being manly to work your way through college. Not that my mother didn't send me money. On Christmas and birthdays. And I took that and had me a blowout, a real one with trimmings for days, and then went back to hashing or whatever it was. They didn't take me in the army. Bad feet. When he got back from the war, he was full of beans about it. He had been a colonel of artillery and had had himself a wonderful time. He had got there early enough to fire off a lot of iron at the Germans and to dodge a lot of their stuff in reply. In the Spanish-American War, he hadn't got farther than a case of flux in Florida. But now his happiness was complete. He felt that all the years he had been making maps of Caesar's campaigns and making working models of catapults and ballistas and scorpions and wild asses and battering rams along ancient and medieval lines hadn't been wasted. Well, they hadn't been wasted as far as I was concerned, for I used to help him make them when I was a kid, and the tricks were wonderful little gadgets. For a kid, anyway. And the war hadn't been wasted either, for he had made a visit to Ely-sur-Rhin, which was where Caesar beat Vercingetorix, and toward the end of the summer after he got back, he had Foch and Caesar and Pershing and Haig and Vercingetorix and Critognatus and Vercassivellaunus and Ludendorff and Edith Cavell pretty well mixed up in his mind. And he got out all the catapults and scorpions we had made and dusted them off. But he'd been a good officer, they said, and a brave man. He had a medal to prove it. I suppose that for a long time I took a snotty tone about the judge as hero, because it was a fashion for a while to take such a tone about heroes, and I grew up in that fashion. Or perhaps it was because I had bad feet and never got into the army, or even the SATC when I was in college, and therefore had the case of sour grapes that the wallflower always has. Perhaps if I'd been in the army, everything would have been different. But the judge was a brave man, even if he did have a medal to prove it. He had proved it before he ever got the medal, and he was to prove it again. There was, for instance, the time a fellow he had sent up to the pen stopped him in the street down at the landing and told me he was going to kill him. The judge just laughed and turned his back and walked away. The fellow took out a pistol then and called to the judge 2 or 3 times. Finally, the judge looked around. When he saw the man had a pistol and had it pointing at him, the judge turned right there and walked straight at the man, not saying a word. He got right up to the man and took the pistol away from him. What he did in the war, I never knew.
This ends Disc 5. O the King's Men, Disc 6.
The night my mother and the young executive and I went to dinner at his place, nearly 15 years later, he dug up some of the junk again. There were the Pattons, a couple who lived down the row, and a girl named Demond, whose presence I took to be tribute to me, and Judge Irwin and us. Digging up the ballista was, I suppose, a tribute to me, too, though he always had shown a tendency to instruct his guests in the art of war of the pre-gunpowder epochs. All during the meal it had been old times, which was another tribute to me, for you come back to the place you have been, and they always start chewing over that bone, old times. Old times, just before dessert, worked around to how I used to make models with him. So he got up and went into the library and came back with a ballista, about 20 inches long, and shoved his dessert to one side and set it up there on the table. Then he cocked it, using the little crank on the draw drum to wind back the carriage, just as though he hadn't been strong enough to do it with a finger or two all at once. Then he didn't have anything to shoot, so he rang for the black boy and got a roll. He broke open the roll and removed a little hunk of the soft bread and tried to make a pellet of it. It didn't make a very good pellet, so he dipped it in water to make it stick. He put it in the carriage. "Now," he said, "it works like this," and tipped the trigger. It worked. The pellet was heavy with a good soaking, and the zip hadn't gone out of the ballista with the passage of years. For the next thing I knew, there was an explosion in the chandelier, and Mrs. Patton screamed and spewed mint ice over her black velvet, and bits of glass showered down over the tablecloth and the big bowl of japonicas. The judge had made it dead center on an electric light bulb. He had also fetched down one of the crystal bangles of the chandelier. The judge said he was very sorry about Mrs. Patton. He said that he was a very stupid old man in his second childhood to be playing with toys, and then sat up very straight in his chair to show what a chest and pair of shoulders he still had. Mrs. Patton ate the rest of the mint ice, punctuating her activity with distrustful glances at the disgraceful ballista. Then we all went back into the judge's library to wait for the coffee and the brandy bottle. But I loitered behind in the dining room for a moment. I have said that the zip hadn't gone out of the ballista with the passage of the years, but that was a misstatement of fact. It hadn't had a chance to. I went over to examine the thing, with a motive more sentimental than scientific. But then I noticed the twists, which gave it its zip. There are 2 twists of fiber on all those things, ballistas, some types of catapults, scorpions, and wild asses, through each of which the butt of a propelling arm is adjusted to make, as it were, half of the bow and a kind of super crossbow. We used to cheat by mixing in catgut and fine steel wire with the string of the twists on our models to give more force. Now, as I looked at the thing, I realized that the twists weren't the old twists which I had put in back in the dear dead days. Not by a damn sight. They were practically new. And all at once I had the sight of Judge Irwin sitting up nights back in the library with catgut and steel wire and string and pliers and scissors on the desk beside him, and with his high old red-thatched head bent over, the yellow eyes gimleted upon the task. And seeing that picture in my head, I felt sad and embarrassed. I'd never felt anything one way or the other about the judges making those things in the first place, years back. When I was a kid, it seemed natural that anybody in his right mind would want to make them, and read books about them, and make maps and models. And it had kept on seeming all right that the judge had made them. But the picture I now had in my head was different. I felt sad and embarrassed and somehow defrauded. So I joined the guests in the library and left a piece of Jack Burden in the dining room with the ballista, for good and all. They were having coffee, all except the judge, who was opening up a bottle of brandy. He looked up as I came in and said, "Been looking at our old pea shooter, huh?" He He put the slightest emphasis upon our. "Yes," I said. The yellow eyes bored right into me for a second, and I knew he knew what I'd found out.
"I fixed it up," he said, and laughed the most candid and disarming laugh in the world. "The other day, you know, an old fellow with nothing to do and nobody to talk to. You can't read law and history and Dickens all the time, or fish."
I grinned a grin, which I somehow felt I had to grin as a tribute to something not specified in my mind. But I knew that the grin was about as convincing as cold chicken broth in a boarding house. Then I went over and sat beside the Demand girl, who'd been provided for my delight. She was a prettyish, dark girl, well got up but lacking something, too brittle and vivacious, with a trick of lassoing you with her anxious brown eyes and fluttering the eyelids as she cinched the rope and then saying what her mother had told her 10 years before to say.
"Oh, Mr. Burden, they say you're in politics. Oh, it must be just fascinating."
No doubt her mother had taught her that. Well, she was pushing 30 and it hadn't worked yet, but the eyelids were still busy. "No, I'm not in politics," I said. "I've just got a job."
"Tell me about your job, Mr. Burden."
"I'm an office boy," I said.
"Oh, they say you're very important, Mr. Burden. They say you're very influential. Oh, it must be fascinating to be influential, Mr. Burden."
"It's news to me," I said, and discovered that they were all looking at me, as though it had just dawned on them that I was sitting there buck naked on the couch beside Miss Dumond with a demitasse on my knee. "It's the human fate. Every time some dame like Miss Dumond snags you and you have to start talking the way you have to talk to dames like Miss Dumond, the whole world starts listening in." I saw the judge smiling with what I took to be a vengeful relish. Then he said,
"Don't let him kid you, Miss Dumond. Jack is very influential."
"I knew it," Miss Dumond said. "It must be fascinating."
"All right," I said, "I'm influential. You got any pals in the pen you want me to get a pardon for?" Then I thought, "Wonderful manners you've got, Jack. You might at least smile if you've got to say that." So I smiled.
"Well, there's going to be somebody in the pen," old Mr. Patton said, "before it's over. What's going on up there in the city? All these..."
"George,"
his wife breathed at him, but it didn't do any good. For Mr. Patton was the bluff, burly type, with lots of money and a manly candor. He kept right on,
"Yes, sir, all these wild goings on. While that fella's giving his state away, free this and free that and free other, every wool-hat jackass thinking the world is free, who's going to pay? That's what I want to know. What's he say to that, Jack?"
"I never asked him," I said.
"Well, you ask him," Mr. Patton said, "and ask him, too, how much grabbing there is. All that money flowing, and don't tell me there's not a grab. And ask him what he's going to do when they impeach him. Tell him there's a constitution in this state, or was, before he blew it to hell. Tell him that."
"I'll tell him," I said, and laughed, and then laughed again when I thought how Willie would look if I did tell him.
"George," the judge said, "you're an old fogey. Government is committed these days to give services we never heard of when we were growing up. The world's changing."
"It was changed so much a fella can step in and grab the whole state. Give him another few years and nothing can blast him out. He'll have half the state on a payroll and the other half will be afraid to vote. Strong arm, blackmail, God knows what."
"He's a hard man," the judge said. "He's played it hard and close, but there's one principle he's grasped. You don't make omelets without breaking eggs. And precedence. He's broken plenty of eggs and he may make his omelets. And remember, the Supreme Court has backed him up on every issue raised to date."
"Yeah, and it's his court, since he got Armstrong on and Talbot, and the issues raised. But what about the issues that haven't been raised, that people have been afraid to raise?"
"There's a great deal of talk," the judge said calmly, "but we don't really know much."
"I know he's going to tax this state to death," Mr. Patton said, and shifted his big hams and glared, "and drive business out of this state, raising royalty on the state coal land, on the oil land, on..."
"Yes, George," the judge laughed, "and he slammed an income tax on you and me, too."
"On the oil situation now," the young executive began, for the sacred name of oil had been mentioned, "as I see it, the situation..."
Well, Miss Dumont had certainly opened the corral gate when she mentioned politics, and it was thunder of hoofs and swirl of dust from then on, and I was sitting on the bare ground in the middle of it. For a while it didn't occur to me that there was anything peculiar about the scene. Then it did occur to me. After all, I did work for the fellow who had the tail and cloven hoof, and this was, or had started out to be, a social occasion.